Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company versus the Honorable Jack R. King, an original mandamus proceeding. Valerie Harrell versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company from Tarrant County. Plainsman Trading Company versus Thomas W. Cruz and Dorothy Cruz from Duval County, and the Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation versus the Honorable Harold C. Gaker, another original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and conclude these arguments before the lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. We are now ready to hear from relator in Mid-American versus King.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas S. Brandon, Jr. will present arguments for relator. Relator will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, your honors, this case is not really a factually intensive case, but a dispute about the interpretation and application of a particular statute, i.e. Section 11D of Article 136 of the Texas Insurance Code. The timeline of facts that has been presented on the board here and also a copy given to each of the justices, I believe, are undisputed. So the thrust of my argument will focus on the legal interpretation and application of the statute as amended. I guess the first question the court needs to ask is Section 11D of Article 136 applicable to this case. Section 11 of this article was amended September 1, 1993. As you can see from the timeline, this case was already pending. And in fact, the respondent, the Honorable Jack King, had overruled the motion to require bond two different times. I believe the original motion was filed in January. It was overruled in March of 93. Motion to reconsider was in April, and the motion was overruled on or about May the 18th of 93. Then this amendment was passed. So the question is, does an amended statute such as this have applicability to pending cases? And we're not asking for a retroactive application of this statute, but an application to the present pending cases.
Just a question. I was a little bit confused. Did the 93 amendments, would Mid-American be considered an eligible surplus line carrier under the 93 amendments?
Yes, sir. Okay. At that time, at the time of the amendment, it was eligible to write business in the state of Texas.
No. It seemed to me there was an argument that some amendments in the 93 amendments also increased the requirements of a surplus line carrier.
There were capital requirements, surplus capital and surplus requirements that were increased, yes.
Would Mid-American have been considered an eligible surplus line carrier based on the requirements of the 93 amendment?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well,
at
which in 1993.
In 1993 it was, until the end of 93.
January, so it did meet the requirements as set forth in the 93 amendments when that statute was passed.
That's correct. And according to showing the timeline there, it was and remained eligible to January 1, 1994. I believe the case law says that procedural.
Maybe I'm sorry. I can't tell by your answer, and I may be dense on this. The 93 amendments increased the requirements for an insurer to meet the requirements of a surplus line carrier. Mid-American, when it was writing its insurance in 88, met those increased requirements. Yes?
That's correct.
Okay. Now I'm clear. Thank you.
That's correct. This is a procedural statute, and pursuant to the case law, as cited in the relator's letter brief, including this court's decisions in Tyra versus Houston and Holder versus Wood. These cases, this court, Supreme Court has held that amended statutes which are procedural apply to pending cases as opposed to substantive statutes. This is particularly true when there's no savings clause in the statute exempting the application from pending litigation. Is Article 136 a procedural statute? We would say yes. As stated in Section 1 of Chapter 46 of the Acts 1987 of the 70th Legislature, it states the purpose of this statute, Article 136. The purpose of this act is to clarify and consolidate the procedure for effecting service of process on companies doing the business of insurance in the state of Texas, whether licensed or not, to provide general instructions for unique circumstances, and to establish fees for service of legal process and related documentation. The legislative purpose and intent of the enactment of Article 136 was procedural. Any amendment to a procedural statute, of course, by its nature, we would contend, is also procedural.
I thought one of the purposes of the statute was to make sure that insurance companies like this could satisfy their legal responsibilities to pay claims in the state of Texas. Is that not one of the purposes?
That's not, we're talking about the purpose of Article 136, which is the service of process on all insurance companies. So the statute that I was referring to is only that. Now, Article 114-2, which is the surplus lines insurer statute, is that statute, Your Honor, which says here's what an insurance company, an unauthorized insurance company, has to do, the hoops they have to jump through in order to write insurance in the state of Texas.
Which imposes a bonding requirement?
No, there's no bonding requirement in 114-2, or Article 114-2 of the Texas Insurance Code. The only bonding requirement is in Article 136, Section 11, and it's related to, as we contend, unauthorized insurers, which does not include surplus lines carriers. Certainly the statute in 11D, as amended, exempts surplus lines carriers that were eligible at the time the coverage was issued. Mid-American was. The policy was issued December 31, 1989, and through valid through the end of that year. It was eligible all during that time. We believe then that the Section 11D is applicable to this case because it is a procedural matter. We're not asking for retroactive application, but an application to a pending lawsuit. As stated in the timeline, the effective date of this section was for 11D was September 1, 1993. They filed their second motion to require bond in March of 94, and the court eventually entered an order on March 21, 1994. The real parties in interest attempt to make a point that the surplus lines insurer, as defined under Section 114-2, this is the amended version in the 93, also requires that the surplus lines insurer remains currently eligible. However, the definition does not delineate when the surplus lines insurer is deemed eligible. The definition itself says surplus lines insurers means an unlicensed insurer deemed eligible pursuant to Section 8 of this article in which an insurance coverage is placed or may be placed under this article. It doesn't say when eligible. Section 11D of Article 136 does say when it's eligible, and that's at the time coverage was issued. Besides, requiring some reading that they have to now be eligible, the legislature, in amending Articles 114-1, 114-2, and 136 last legislative session, put the word eligible in front of surplus lines insurer 23 times. The only time it didn't do it was when it amended 11D and also Section 7 and 8 of Article 136. So if the legislature had intended current eligibility, certainly it would have put that in the statute. I think part of the problems, Your Honors, is that there has been confusion in the past as to the application of Article 114.1, which is the Unauthorized Insurance Act, and 114-2, which is the Surplus Lines Insurance or Insurer Act. I would like to just take a moment to say, even if 11D didn't apply, It is our contention that Article 136 doesn't apply to a surplus lines insurer. And I think if the court, in our brief, we delineated some of the differences between unlicensed, what I call unauthorized, unlicensed insurance under 114.1 versus unauthorized licensed insurance under 114-2. In Article 114.1, which is your unauthorized, unlicensed insurer, it says that this section, in Section 2, says this does not apply or does not include surplus lines insurance. Section 3 prohibits unauthorized insurance under this article and subjects persons guilty of the same to a civil fine of not more than $10,000. Section 7 provides automatic attorney's fees and that a refusal to defend a case or make a payment is considered prima facie evidence that its failure was vexatious and without reasonable cause. Section 8 says that contracts entered into with unauthorized insurers, we're talking about unauthorized, unlicensed insurers, are unenforceable by such insurer. In other words, it can't rely on its contract defenses or exclusions. Article 136, sections 7 through 11 apply to these same unauthorized, unlicensed insurers. Now, opposed to that is the characteristics of Article 114.2, which are the unauthorized, licensed insurers, or your surplus lines insurers. Section 2 says it must be secured through a surplus lines agent. Section 3 says that surplus lines insurance is authorized based upon certain conditions. Section 6A requires some filing with the stamping office, including evidence of uninsurability in a new contract. Section 8, eligibility determined based on capital surplus. And in addition, an eligible surplus lines carrier has to have a trust fund of at least $1.5 million, which MidAmerican did have, as opposed to Article 114.1, where no trust fund is required. And 114.1 is penal in nature, as opposed to 114.2, which permits the thing, if you're unauthorized, but you jump through these hoops, you can write business in the state of Texas. And MidAmerican did that.
Even assuming everything you say is true, how is this a violation of Walker versus Packard such that we should grant the extraordinary writ? I mean, if this is a big solvent insurance company, what's the problem in posting this bond, going ahead with this litigation, and if you're right, you're out the premium, perhaps?
Well, one of the practical problems, Your Honor, is that if we have to post a bond based upon plaintiff's allegations of what they think the damage is going to be, for example, if they claim the damage is $1 million, and the insurance company reserves that loss at, let's say, $100,000, you can see that that's going to be a problem, not just with that one case, but if that same principle then is replicated to not only in this one case, but in other cases involving this insurer, not even a solvent, good insurance company is going to be able to stay in business because someone could come in and allege $100 million. And if the judge believes that that's necessary, they can then
Well, that's one case, but this would be a this would be an order of a judge with no opinion in it, and you're saying it's very important that we step in here, grant a mandamus here, and write on it so that that wouldn't happen in some as of yet unfiled, unknown case down
the
road.
Right. As I think we said in a brief, for us, our insurance company, it's been threatened in other cases, and in fact, one motion has already been filed. And so we have already seen that issue. The other issue, maybe I will address on my rebuttal, but I think that the other issue is that this is a void court order, and being a void court order, we're entitled to a mandamus relief because it's a clear violation of the statutory exemption. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me just ask again. Legislative purpose of these statutes pertaining, as you say, to an unauthorized licensed insurer, isn't to make sure that you're going to be around to pay claims, the capitalization requirements?
Yes. The Article 114-1 114-2, which is the applicable one for us, surplus lines insurance. That is the legislative purpose. And the regulatory purpose is, if you jump through these hoops, we believe that you're going to be solvent, you're going to be able to pay these claims.
And following up on the Chief Justice's question, though, if, in fact, your insurance company is in such tenuous financial condition that it may not be able to pay future claims because of the necessity of posting this bond, doesn't that serve legislative purpose to make sure that you're able to meet current claims?
I think that's a judicial function that goes beyond what was intended, because as I said, the trust fund has been established.
That's $1.5 million?
At least $1.5 million.
That's not much money these days, is it?
No, not too much. But that was provided for and is still in existence. And as we said in our responses, no claims have been filed against that trust fund this time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the responses.
May it please the court, is Leanne Johnson an argument for respondent?
May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Leanne Johnson. I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Rudy Gloria and Carlos Lopez, two Houston, Texas residents who purchased insurance from Mid-American Indemnity Company back in January of 1990. Now, when they purchased this insurance, they purchased a comprehensive general liability policy. They also purchased contractual indemnity coverage. The reason why we're here today is not, as Mid-American would have it, simply to decide some issue relating to 1.36 and its application to a foreign unauthorized insurance company. The reason we're here today is because Carlos Lopez and Rudy Gloria and Lopez Gloria Construction Company and the general contractor out on this job, Williams Brothers Construction Company, purchased at the expense of over $50,000 a policy that these people say doesn't provide them any coverage. And that's the underlying dispute that...
Well, we're not deciding.
No, Your Honor, but that is the underlying dispute that is the background. It's not a timeline. It's not these facts. Conspicuously left off of the timeline, I find, is that at all times, Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company, a Cayman Island insurance company, owned by 19 other Cayman Island corporations, and who knows, I don't know who owns those corporations, that entity is, was, and will always be, by virtue of the Texas Insurance Code, whether it's 1.141 or 1.142, an unauthorized insurer in the state of Texas.
Is your only, or I should say main interest, to make sure that if you win this underlying coverage lawsuit that you're going to be able to collect?
Your Honor, I think that is a primary emphasis, and in fact, that's one of the purposes, as you pointed out, wasn't one of the purposes when the Texas legislature first passed this type of statute over 40 years ago. And by the way, this statute, or a form of 1.36, has been in existence in Texas for over 40 years. Section 21.38 of the Texas Insurance Code was the very first promulgation by the Texas legislature to protect Texas insurers against foreign insurance companies.
And how is that interest going to be served any better, except perhaps it's more expeditious if the defendant's pleadings are struck and you're entitled to a default judgment? But how is it interest going to be served any better by the bonding requirement, as opposed to your trying your lawsuit and winning it on the merits, perhaps and then seeking to undertake collection efforts against this insurance company?
Your Honor, I think the interest is served better, and in fact, this provision was contained in the original statute where the legislature said, we have found that Texas residents face almost an insurmountable burden of trying to collect judgments in foreign jurisdictions once they obtain their judgment. And so what we need to do is protect these Texas residents and Texas insurers from foreign corporations by giving them the added protection of the bond provision. And that's how it protects us and gives us. What it does is it says, look, foreign insurer, you have, assuming it's brought to the court's attention, and here it was, there's no question on that. Assuming it's brought to the court's attention, the court in this instance held two hearings. The first hearing, there's very little, in fact, I don't think there's any evidence of in the record of the first hearing. We do have a record on the second hearing. At that hearing, the court, in its discretion, looked at the issue because the statute 2138, its subsequent version of 1.14-1 subsection 6 and 1.14-2 subsection 11, and then finally in 1987, those two were combined into 1.36, which is the provision that we're talking about today. I disagree. First of all, let me just clear up one thing. Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company has never been a licensed insurer in the state of Texas. They have always been an unauthorized insurer. The Texas Surplus Line Statute in 1.14-2 specifically says the legislature declares that such transaction of surplus lines insurance is a subject of concern and that it is necessary to provide for the regulation, taxation, supervision, and control of these and of such transactions and the practices and matters related thereto. Now that's exactly what the legislature did over 40 years ago when it passed the original bond provision, and that's what it's done in 1.36. I think it's particularly important to remember what the legislative purpose was behind the original bond provision as well as the subsequent enacted one, which is 1.36. When you do that, I think you come to the conclusion that the argument that is being proposed by Mid-American that subsection D somehow exempts them is totally ludicrous. And the reason why it makes no sense is when 1.36, and I believe, Justice Enoch, you had the question about whether or not they would have been eligible under the new provisions of 1.36 when they were passed in 1993. It did several things. It increased the surplus that was required from these foreign insurers. It required auditing of their financials. It required them to file the proper statements with the State Board of Insurance. It required over 10 different things that had to occur before that insurance company could continue to do business in the state of Texas. Now, the question was, would Mid-American have been eligible in 1990 when they originally wrote the policy under the new requirements of 1.14-2 Section 8, which is the section dealing with the requirements of surplus lines insurers? And the answer is absolutely not. And the evidence in the record, the only evidence in the record of how eligible were they, is evidence that came from the Texas State Board of Insurance and the hearing that was held in September of 93. And you notice that's not on the board, but in September of 93, at the time when this statute was supposedly going to become effective, subsection D was going to become effective, the Texas State Board of Insurance and Mid-American had a hearing. And at that hearing, one of the primary issues that was to be determined was whether or not Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company was able to meet the requirements of the statute. By virtue of, and I believe it's Exhibit 1 to F of the record, the Commissioner of Insurance had an administrative judge appointed. He rendered findings of fact and conclusions of law. Those findings of fact and conclusions of law particularly apply here because what he found was there are major problems with Mid-America Indemnity Insurance.
Counsel, what was the date of those findings?
The date on the document, February 1 of 94.
As of September 1 of 93, was Mid-American an eligible surplus lines insurer?
Under the old provision that would have been in effect prior to 1993, all we know is based upon the certificate which they filed, okay, and through the stamping office of the policies that they filed, that they were considered an eligible surplus lines insurer.
I'm talking about specifically on the September 1 of 93, through these findings of the insurance board.
Yes.
Was Mid-American an eligible surplus lines insurer?
Through the findings? No. In fact, through the findings, the finding of fact number, I believe it was finding of fact and conclusion of law of the judge said that they didn't find any evidence. Mid-American had failed to present proper evidence to them of their eligibility.
And my question is, when officially, in terms of the Commissioner of Insurance, when officially, from their perspective, did this company cease to be an eligible surplus lines insurer?
There are two documents that would answer that question. Mm-hmm. Under the findings of fact and conclusions of law by the judicial administrative judge, he could not find any evidence that they were, quote, continuing to be eligible based upon the review. However, there was a document that was filed by the Texas State Board of Insurance indicating that their eligibility ran from year to year, and that if the last time that it had been considered in 1993, it would have run until the end of 93. So, in a sense, there is some evidence that they would have been eligible as of September 1, 1993. However, by virtue of the judicial findings of the administrative judge, there is a real question as to whether or not they would be. And in fact, the judge looked at the issue of whether or not they could have even, as of September of 93, one of the questions was, they were coming into the court or into to the State Board of Insurance and saying, look, we think we're exempt. We think we shouldn't have to apply, you shouldn't apply all these new surplus lines things to us. We think we're an exempt company. Now, in order to meet that exemption, and the exemption is set forth in 1.14-2, Section 8, they had to meet 10 different requirements.
September 1 on?
Yes.
Not before then?
No. Before that, the requirements would only have been what would have been in effect prior to that day. Now, there were some requirements, Your Honor.
And is there any question that Mid-American met those requirements at the time coverage was issued?
At the time coverage was issued, no, because the requirements at the time coverage was issued were much lower.
So it's your position that Section 11 means that you have got to have met at the time coverage was issued the requirements after September the 1st, 1993?
Not necessarily. No, Your Honor. Let me see if I can clarify what our position is. Our position in the case is that 1.36, first of all, subsection D that was added September of 93, does not apply retroactively to Texas insurers who had purchased policies prior to that day from these surplus lines carriers, number one. Number two, even if this court were to determine that that somehow, for some reason, they were going to apply that substantive provision retroactively, then we still believe that under the 1993 amendments, the court can reach only one conclusion, and that conclusion is Mid-American must post a bond. Subsection D does not apply to Mid-American.
Why not?
The reason why it does not apply, Your Honor, is because in 1993, when the legislature enacted the changes to the Texas Insurance Code, they did so for one major purpose.
Well, but look at the language, though. Why not from the language? I understand you say that this doesn't make any sense, but from the language itself, why doesn't it apply?
Because from the language itself, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Because from the language itself, Your Honor, it says a surplus lines carrier or insurer, okay, reading the statute, and then it says, shall be exempt from the provisions of this as long as they were eligible at the time the policy was written. All right,
that's a
paraphrase. Right. However, what the legislature did in 1993, in addition to amending and adding subsection D, now remember, the purpose is to provide added protection to Texas residents. So what the legislature did when they added subsection D, they changed the definition of the word surplus lines insurer, which are the first words used in subsection D. So what you have to do is go back to 1.14-2, section 2, and read the new definition of that subsection. Because if you're going to apply the 1993 amendments, then you have to apply them across the board, and certainly that should include the new definition. Under the new definition of 1.14-2, 1.14-2, subsection 2, the court will note that the definition previous to that time, a surplus lines insurer, was defined as an unauthorized insurer.
As an unauthorized insurer.
Now what the court has, or what the legislature has done when they added subsection 1.14-2, 1.36 subsection D, when they added that, they also changed the definition of surplus lines insurer to require them to be an eligible surplus lines insurer pursuant to 1.14-2 section 8 of this article. That's the wording.
So it is your argument that they must have been able to meet the new requirements at the time coverage was issued. That is your argument.
No, Your Honor. For subsection D to apply, okay, for subsection D to apply to this situation, they had to prove, they would have to, for them to rely on that statute, they would have to say, look, I was eligible back in 1990.
And the only way
okay,
they could do that is to show that they met,
eligible.
Is they show that they met the requirements, the new requirements back then.
No, Your Honor.
No, the old requirements.
They could have been eligible back in 1990, that's true, but they have to remain eligible. That's the issue that is the problem. The statute was written...
It says at the date applicable coverage is issued.
That's right, but the first part of the definition of surplus lines insurer is that they were an eligible, are an eligible surplus lines insurer as according to 1.14-2, subsection 8. And that's the problem. They cannot meet that definition. The new definition of the statute is clear. They have to meet that definition. They cannot ask for the court to apply subsection D retroactively and only that amendment. This court must also apply the remainder of those amendments.
Assuming we agree with every word you've said so far, why doesn't this violate the open court's provision under the... our communications versus Sharp as we applied it there?
Your Honor, it does not violate the open court provision, first of all, because the open court provision, we have to remember what we're dealing with here. Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company is a foreign, unauthorized insurer. The industry that we're regulating, that the state of Texas has a compelling interest to regulate, is insurance. We have been granted that right not only by common law, but also by the McCarran-Ferguson Act. The United States Supreme Court has specifically upheld delineations between foreign versus resident insurers or foreign versus non-resident individuals.
Under the due process clause?
Yes, Your Honor, they
but
have.
But have we ever made a similar distinction under the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution?
Directly on point, no. However, Your Honor, the interesting point is that the open court provision doesn't apply, I don't believe, to Mid-American. Mid-American is asserting, the important thing about the open court provision is its original, the framers of the Constitution, had what they had in mind when they drafted it was that it would remain allow Texas citizens access to the courts to continue to assert common law rights.
Sometimes our Constitution uses the word citizens, and sometimes it uses the word persons. And Article 1, Section 13 uses the word persons. Does it not?
It does, Your Honor. It says all persons. However, various courts, including this court, have stated on previous occasions that the primary purpose of that statute was to protect Texas residents' access to court.
Well, I saw a quote in your brief that used the word citizen, but I've never seen a holding to that.
No, Your Honor. I don't know that it's been a, quote, holding.
I mean, sometimes
that
we may have,
been
paraphrasing
person.
It, used the word citizen, but I don't think that's going to wipe a farm.
But I do think, Your Honor, that this court has repeatedly held that provision is for common law rights. Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company was not granted any right under 1.36 subsection D or any other bond provision. The court must look to the class of persons that statute was intended to protect.
Well, but Mid-American's trying to assert, I presume, a general denial in a lawsuit that your clients brought and to defend itself in a state district court, that's not an assertion of a common law right?
Your Honor, no, it's not, because Mid-Americans, what they are asking for the court to do is to render 1.36, which is the bond provision, which is statutory. Their existence in this state as a foreign unauthorized insurer is specifically limited to the existence they're provided for by
statute. Well, the legislature may not have had to even let them write insurance in this state, but assuming they did, aren't they entitled to the same rights as any other litigant in Texas state courts under the open courts provision?
No, Your Honor, they're not entitled to the same rights as any other individual. They're entitled to those rights that are granted to them as a foreign unauthorized insurer under whether it be statutory or
constitutional. So when the legislature allows someone to write insurance in the state of Texas, a Cayman Islands Corporation, it can do so in a limited fashion and limit or restrict what would otherwise be their rights under the open courts provision or any other provision of the Texas Constitution?
As far as any other provision of the Texas Constitution, I'm not prepared to say something that broadly, but I am prepared to say that for purposes of what we have here today, the open courts provision and the provision of the bonding requirement does not violate the open courts provision. It's
in TAM and in Trinity River, we said the open courts had three things. One, you had to actually have a court. And create a county without a court. And also that access to common law rights could not be unreasonably restricted. But the third thing was is that there could not be unreasonable financial barriers to participation in the court system. And that's what the TAB case is about. And I don't understand that that has anything to do with common law rights.
Your Honor, I think this court, in fact, has upheld, and I don't know if these cases were cited in our brief, but and I can provide you with the cites. This court has previously upheld provisions, for example, like Rule 143, which requires the posting of costs. If the court deems it's necessary, they can order either party or both parties to post sufficient costs so that there will be adequate protection when these people go, when a suit goes to trial. That provision was specifically upheld by the Texas Supreme Court. Now, the issue in that case is pretty similar to what we have here.
And that's cost. This is the whole thing.
Your Honor, this is not the whole thing, because actually the bond that was instituted by the court, required by the court, was only for millions, and our damages are probably going to be way in excess of that. But ironically, the issue, I do think the issue is the same, Your Honor, because the question, the argument that was made there was that, oh, it unreasonably restricts our right to have access to the court because you're asking us to post this bond. The court, in that instance, the balancing test that this court must use, if the court decides for some reason open courts analysis, that provision, that they have standing to bring that claim, which I do not believe they do, but if the court does decide to engage in that analysis, then a balancing test is applied. And the balancing test is we must determine whether or not Texas has a legitimate interest in regulating foreign unauthorized insurers and a legitimate interest to protect the rights and welfare of Texas insurers who purchase insurance. And our premium dollars go over to these foreign countries to make sure that we have the right to have protection in the event that we obtain a judgment.
Are you still answering? It sounds to me like you've gone beyond.
I have a question that I'd like to get an answer to on the eligibility issue. You state in your brief that as of September 1, 1993, Mid-American was no longer eligible to do business, and therefore this exception on the bond doesn't apply. And you cite us back to Exhibit F and the hearing examiner's findings in support of that statement. But when you go and look at the findings of fact, there's a specific finding that says as of the date of the hearing, that was November 9, 1993, Mid-American was an eligible surplus lines insurer in the state of Texas. Now, why doesn't that finding dispose of your argument and dispose of this case?
Because, Your Honor, the eligibility that they're referring to is the eligibility under the old statute. And in order for Mid-American to assert that subsection D applies to them by 1993 standards, they have to comply with what is termed, what is defined an eligible surplus lines insurer in 1993 standards.
Well, where does it say in this order that this is an eligible surplus lines insurer under the old statute as opposed to the 93 statute? This hearing took place after the effective date of the new amendment.
Yes,
where does it say in the commissioner's order that this is not a finding of eligibility as of the date of the hearing, November 9, 93? That's what it said.
Your Honor, the whole purpose of this hearing was to determine whether or not Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company could qualify for the exemption provision under the new higher surplus lines requirements, okay, the surplus requirements under the statute. The court, also attached to that same motion, there is a Texas Department of Insurance certification which indicates that what Mid-American Indemnity Insurance Company was doing was filing an application for exemption from capital and surplus lines requirements. That's on, I believe, page 129 of the record. Now, what the court the findings that the court makes, the conclusions of law are that pursuant to Texas Insurance Code annotated Article 1.14-2, Section A as added, applicant applied for an exemption from the higher capital and surplus requirements in the state of Texas after December 31, 1993. The Commissioner of Insurance has jurisdiction and they go forward and basically they find they have failed to present adequate evidence of the application for the exemption. So what the court was determining, what they were doing is looking at the assets. It's interesting to note, Your Honor, in relation to your issue, that what the court also made, for example, finding of fact number 14, no actuarial opinion was provided as part of applicant's 1991 or 1992 financial statement. Applicant's audit for 1992 was inadequate.
How did that undercut the express finding that as of November 9, 1993, they were an eligible surplus lines insurer? Regardless of what they may have been after that date, how does that undercut that specific finding?
Your Honor, I don't think that finding applies to what the judge was looking at here, okay, in the hearing. I think what the way it normally would work in that instance was that Mid-American would have applied in, for example, January 1 of 1993 for their applicant for the remainder of the year because of various increases in the surplus line statute in September of 93. The court, the judicial judge or administrative law judge was trying to determine and Mid-American wanted them to determine whether or not they could continue to do business after that time frame. And in fact, they could not. And it is our position, if I can just make one, and I don't know if that answered your question. Do you need?
But that answered the question.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Kim.
Mr. Brandon, just a kind of a preliminary question. In the record, you provided this court with a copy of a letter from Mr. Jamail, attorney for Williams Brothers Construction, ostensibly making an offer on behalf of Gloria Lopez that they would agree to try this case without requiring the bond and permit the insurance company to rely on its current pleadings and any defenses it wanted to raise. Is that still, I mean, what happened to that? Do you recall it's an October 19th letter?
Well,
addressed to Mr.
We believe that in some senses he was inviting the lower court to make error by, he didn't say anything about removing the default judgment, which had already been entered against us, and determining what issues, and there was never any clarification as to what he was referring to on, you know, defenses or whatever. And as I said, there was no determination that we would, you know, reverse the default or remove that. and that you could go to trial with that. But we still had the sword of Damocles hanging over us with regard to this bond posting requirement, and feel like that was important.
If you had won, if it says they intended to try the case without requiring you to post a bond, if you'd won the case, would this issue be moved now?
If we had gone to trial and had won the case, hopefully, yes, this would have been moved at this point. But at the same time, they're not willing, and their motion, when they filed a motion to modify this court stay order and go to trial in December, they said it on one hand, but on the other hand, they said, well, we're not waiving anything regarding the posting of bond requirements, and so they're trying to have their cake, in a sense, and eat it too. Which brings me to one quick point, and that is with regard to the financial stability of Mid-America. And I believe that if the opposing counsel, real parties in interest, had really been concerned about that, they could have offered that several months ago, back in April. We could have gone to trial and dealt with this issue, but that offer wasn't even made until after this court stayed the proceeding, and then they and I believe they've been using it as a settlement hammer against us. With regard to the issue that was raised on the open courts provision, I think it's instructive for the court to look at Section 9A of Article 114-2, which is the surplus line statute. That statute says insurance contracts procured as surplus lines coverage from unauthorized insurers in accordance with this article, which I think is undisputed that this policy was issued under this article, the 114-2. Article 114-2, which is the surplus line statute. That statute says insurance contracts procured as surplus lines coverage from unauthorized insurers in accordance with this article, which I think is undisputed that this policy was issued under this article, the 114-2. Shall be given or shall be fully valid and enforceable as to all parties, and shall be given recognition in all matters and respects to the same effect and extent as like contracts issued by authorized insurers, domestic, admitted, authorized insurers, and Texas Insurance Company. When we issued the policy pursuant to this article, I believe that we had every right to be in court that a Texas insurance company would have, and are protected then by the Texas Constitution and the open courts provision. With regard to the questions that were asked by Justice Owen, Exhibit C, I believe, refers to the certificate of eligibility stating that Mid-American was eligible all the way until the end of December of 1993, and since that time has not issued a written coverage in the state of Texas. Again, counsel talked of the definition of surplus lines insurers under the new statute as meaning an unlicensed insurer deemed eligible pursuant to Section 8 of this article in which an insurance coverage is placed. Again, this says that you had to be eligible. It doesn't say when eligible. And our contention is that 11B does define when you have to be eligible, and that really you don't have to be eligible, I don't think, on the effective date of the statute, but you have to be eligible at the time coverage was issued.
Ms. Manning, would it be an unreasonable interpretation of the statute based on what Ms. Johnson has said, that the eligibility in the 93 statute should be read to mean eligible, currently eligible? In other words, you lose your eligibility if at any point in the continuum you quit being eligible. Would it be unreasonable to read the statute that way from the point of view of a legislature that says, if at any time you're eligible to write insurance in this state, and you write insurance, and you sell it to our consumers, you're going to have to remain eligible to have these benefits for the period of time that the consumer may need to rely on your financial stability to cover them. In other words, you know, 4 years in a tort claim or whatever it is, the statute of limitations may be, you would have to maintain your eligibility in this state, prove your ability to satisfy any claims that might be made.
Your Honor, I think that it is very unreasonable to do that. First, if the legislature had intended that, then this chapter, I believe chapter 999 of the legislature, would have put the term eligible in front of this definition of surplus lines insurer, would have put it in the exemption that we're talking about. Because, the reason I say that is because 23 other times in the same statute, the same chapter, it said eligible surplus lines insurer. So if they had meant currently eligible, I think the legislature would have put it in a 24th time and would have said eligible currently today. The second reason I think it is unreasonable is because there are other reasons why an insurance company may be no longer eligible in the state of Texas. For example, if Gainsco or Lloyd's of London or someone comes into Texas as an unauthorized insurer, begins writing pest control policies or other policies like that, finds out that this is not a lucrative market, and then seeks to not write any more policies and withdraws from the state, then if we apply this, then it doesn't matter about the financial wherewithal. They're going to have their pleading struck. They're going to post a bond or whatever. And I think that's highly unreasonable because it has nothing to do, the eligibility may not have anything to do with financial wherewithal.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the second. First call. Thank you.